first of all, nationwide, we're talking about hiring tens of thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands. And contact tracing doesn't really require super specialized training. You can train people who've never done it before, but those individuals also need to be plugged into a system. That system has to include widespread and rapid testing so that tracers can call people before they go out and get other people sick. It also needs to include like computer databases and things like that so that, you know, the tracers can work together and follow up on all these phone numbers. And last of all, you need support for the sick and those you put into quarantine. I mean, if you're going to tell people not to go to the grocery store for 14 days, you better have a plan for getting them groceries.
Right.
And, you know, you put this all together and we're talking about a huge national effort. I mean, it's sort of like a Hoover Dam or something. The government could fund this, and there are plenty of people who need jobs right now. So, I mean, it's possible. We'll just have to see if it can happen.
Is there any technology that's being worked on right now that could help with contact tracing?
Yeah, well, you know, we have technology that we actually have in our pockets right now, these brilliant devices called cell phones that, you know, trace our movements and can right. tell us where we've been and who we've been in contact with. And South Korea and China have been using cell phones to help with contact tracing. Sometimes they've been pretty aggressive. Here in the U.S., there's concerns about privacy, obviously. The ACLU has raised some of those. Google and Apple are working on ways that they can use the technology, hopefully without causing privacy problems. Bottom line, it's hard to imagine that tech won't play a role, but it's not going to be an app that gets us out of this.
All right. NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Thanks, Jeff. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're now going to get a different perspective from Professor Crystal Watson. She is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Along with her colleagues, she has just published a report that outlines a national plan to ease social distancing through contact tracing. She's here with more perspective. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So we have heard a lot from the White House about how the president would like to ease social distancing guidelines, open up the economy in the next few weeks. Based on your team's assessment, under what circumstances could we safely start to ease those guidelines?
It's going to be a combination of a case reduction. We want to see an extended reduction in cases, daily reported cases over time. Also, that hospital capacity is increased, that we can care for the patients safely that are presenting at hospitals. Testing, we need to build up our testing capacity to identify every case. And then we need to build the system for contact tracing all around the country.
So Jeff just outlined what contact tracing is. Can you explain what you're proposing? What would that look like?
Yeah, the U.S. really needs to implement a robust and comprehensive system to identify all COVID-19 cases and trace all of their close contacts of each identified case. So this system is really necessary in order to reduce that burden on hospitals and ease that strict social distancing measures that we have in place right now. And then that helps us confidently make progress towards returning to work and school.
So how would this work? I mean, if someone has COVID, then you're reliant on that person to be able to communicate who they've been in contact with, or you're relying on those friends and acquaintances to self-identify to authorities?
Yeah, so it's a combination of that and possibly the application of technology. So public health does contact tracing all the time for other diseases. So this is something that they know well. But you would ask a person who's been sick who they have come into close contact with. But we can also pair that with technologies to help identify people who have been in the area of this person.
So we heard other countries have employed this. South Korea in particular used cell phone technology, as Jeff mentioned, to identify, track these movements. But there are privacy concerns, right? I mean, how would you implement a program like this while preserving Americans' right to privacy?
Right. Privacy is very important. We need to make sure to address privacy concerns because we need the trust and help of people in our communities to do this. There are, as he said, there are some technologies like Bluetooth that help preserve privacy. They don't explicitly identify you. So we can employ those technologies. But I think people need to understand also that this is going to be important for your health. So imagine that you were in the grocery store, you were near somebody who was actively sick with COVID-19. And then you receive a text message a couple of weeks later, possibly, to say, oh, you might be you might have been exposed. I would want to receive that text message so I know what to do and what to look out for. And I think we are going to have to accept some trade-offs in privacy to try and get this pandemic under control. But privacy is obviously very important. We should minimize any invasion of privacy to the extent we can.
Throughout the pandemic, the Trump administration has been reluctant to make anything a matter of federal policy, right? Instead, leaving the response up to state governments. What's at stake here? What could happen if something like this is left to the states without federal support?
The states need to implement this along with local health departments. That is going to be their job. But what we need from the federal government is planning, guidance, and technical support. That is their job. And they need to do that coordination at the top levels so public health can do their job on the ground.
Professor Crystal Watson, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, we appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we report on an industry that is not receiving federal help. It is the cruise ship industry, which the pandemic has shut down. This global business has discovered a political downside to avoiding many U.S. taxes. NPR's Jim Zaroli explains why.
For Laura Gabaroni and her husband, their two-week cruise around South America quickly turned into a nightmare. Hundreds of passengers got sick. Four died. When I spoke to her a few days ago, Gabaroni, who lives in Florida, was quarantined in their small cabin. Each day, a masked crew member left food at their door, then quickly fled.
We have no contact with anybody else on the ship, crew or other passengers. We are confined to our room 24 hours a day and have been for days.
Her ship, the Zandam, was one of several that have been forced to roam the seas looking for a country willing to let them dock. It's kind of a metaphor for the cruise industry as a whole, which is searching for whatever help it can get right now. Here's Carnival CEO Arnold Donald on CNN.
Obviously, the travel and tourism industry broadly needs the help. This has been devastating for the travel industry. It's certainly been devastating for cruise as part of that.
The industry is hoping to get help from different governments around the world. In the United States, President Trump sounded willing to help at first, but then he shot down the idea altogether.
You know, it's very tough to make a loan to a company when they're based in a different country.
The major cruise companies are all headquartered in the United States, but they're registered in places like Liberia and Panama to avoid taxes, and they mostly employ foreign workers. Ross Klein follows the cruise ship business from Memorial University of Newfoundland.
Their ships are not registered in the U.S. Why would they benefit from the U.S. taxpayer when they pay no U.S. taxes?
Cruise ship industry officials point out that they do own property in the U.S., so they do pay some taxes and fees. Still, they've pretty much given up on federal help and are looking for money on Wall Street. Klein says the biggest companies can probably survive this downturn, but there's going to be a shakeout.
We may see companies disappear. We may see companies being taken over by others. We may see companies shrinking.
Whatever happens, the coronavirus epidemic has been a public relations disaster. Fortunately, some cruise ship fans tend to be pretty loyal, like Laura Gabaroni, whose ship finally docked in Florida on Thursday.
You know, obviously, I want my feet on dry land for quite some time. I don't want to be anywhere but home.
Still, she says she'll probably take a cruise again eventually. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 19 past 8 now, and thanks for listening today. Later this hour, the availability of PPE, or personal protection equipment, has been an enormous concern during the COVID-19 pandemic. Some rural ambulance services in the state are having a hard time keeping up their supplies. WPR's Bram Sablesmith has a report for us in 25 minutes.
Your time is valuable. That's why giving to Wisconsin Public Radio will only take up to a few minutes. Tell us your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay. It's quick and easy to do, and your gift right now really makes a difference. Take the next few minutes to support the station you count on at 888-202-2000. 2552 or WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, full-service solar installers dedicated to making it easy and economical to achieve energy independence. Details on home and business solar options are at allenergysolar.com. Support also comes from Ganschert Nursery and Landscapes, with full-service landscape design and installation to Madison and surrounding communities since 1951, including low-voltage lighting and mosquito repellent systems. Ganschert.com.
Today, maybe not the most spring-like forecast ever. There's a wind advisory for southeastern Wisconsin until tonight, gusts up to 45 miles per hour possible. Winter storm warnings and winter weather advisories for the northeast quadrant of the state. Today in the south, morning snow, then becoming sunny, cloudy with snow in central and northeast Wisconsin. Increasing clouds in the north with rain and snow possible late. It'll be windy around the state and highs in the 30s today.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Elsevier, a global information and analytics business with more than 8,000 staff dedicated to combining content, data, and analytics to turn information into answers. Elsevier.com/careers. From Fidelity Wealth Management, where advisors work with their clients to develop flexible investment strategies that can evolve as their needs change. Learn more at Fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from TransferWise, an online service for sending money abroad, used by more than 7 million people and businesses in 80 countries to send and receive money internationally. More at TransferWise.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The coronavirus has already disrupted this year's elections, with many primaries delayed. But how states, political parties, and the federal government respond now will shape voting come November. Here's NPR's Pam Fessler.
President Trump has made no secret that he doesn't like mail-in voting, even though he and the First Lady cast their ballots that way in last month's Florida primary.
Mail-in voting is a terrible thing. I think if you vote, you should go. And even the concept of early voting is not the greatest, because a lot of things happen.
The president said last week such voting methods are ripe for fraud, although there's little evidence that's been the case. Still, many Republicans are suspicious about efforts to expand mail-in balloting. In response to concerns that in-person voting's too risky during a pandemic, they worry the change could give Democrats the edge.
For better or worse, that's the perception. Now, is that perception based in reality? I don't think that it is.
Michael McDonald, a political scientist at the University of Florida, says there's little evidence that vote by mail favors one party over the other, or even a particular demographic group. Still, it's one of many considerations being weighed as election officials and party operatives try to figure out what to do. Last week's chaotic primary in Wisconsin was a dire warning of what might happen if they don't act. Voters in protective gear waited in line for hours to cast their ballots. And many, like poll worker Josh Spurko, were worried and frustrated.
This is going to be really, really bad. There's going to be less people overall than would have turned out normally. There's probably going to be deaths because of this.
McDonald calls Wisconsin's primary just one canary in the coal mine.
We have a whole flock of canaries that could also be under severe duress when it comes to November.
Several states have already decided to expand mail-in voting for their upcoming primaries. Others are considering doing so. There's even some bipartisan support, despite the opposition of Trump and others in his party. Patrick Ruffini, a Republican strategist, says the real issue is how any new mail-in voting is conducted.
The devil is truly in the details when it comes to designing a vote-by-mail regime where it doesn't already exist.
Ruffini notes that a few states already have predominantly vote-by-mail elections, but most states offer it on a limited basis, and the rules can vary a lot. Some states require excuses, like being ill. Others require witness signatures, or that voters pay the return postage. A few states allow people to collect and turn in ballots for a large number of voters, something Republicans vehemently oppose. Ruffini says it's such details that will make all the difference in who supports what.
anytime the voting system changes, even under non-emergency circumstances, you're going to see each party try to change things in a way that they feel like, you know, that they have the advantage.
And the legal sparring has already begun. Wisconsin Republicans successfully appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling that absentee ballots could be postmarked after Election Day. Texas Democrats also filed suit last week, claiming that their state's restrictive mail-in voting rules are unconstitutional. Tom Bonnier, who runs a Democratic data firm, thinks November's electorate will be a lot different than it would have been before the pandemic, but he's not sure how.
That's the big question, and that's what we're seeking to answer at this point. We just don't know. There are too many factors at play in terms of voter safety, changes in voting mechanisms, changes in the economy, changes in voter registration methods.
Congressional Democrats also want states to allow more early voting and same-day registration to help increase access at the polls. There's a general perception that higher turnout helps Democrats and hurts Republicans, although election experts say that's not necessarily true. Ned Foley, a law professor at Ohio State University, hopes the main goal is to ensure that everybody who wants to vote in November is still able to do so.
The good news is we have time, enough time between now and November to do it. It will be a challenge, but if we are committed to genuine participation for everybody, we ought to be able to meet that challenge.
But he worries about a different scenario, that partisan politics takes over.
And the reason why I'm particularly worried about that is because, you know, any time you get disenfranchisement, that fundamentally undermines the fairness of the system.
And ultimately public trust in the election results. Foley says what happened in Wisconsin, where voters' health was put at risk because of disagreement over the rules, was not encouraging. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
Across this country, millions of parents have abruptly taken over daycare and teaching, even as they continue work. And this week, we're going to hear from some of them.
Lorena Pierce is a special education consultant and advocate in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. She is also the mother of two girls.
I feel like I'm more of a house manager now if I had to give myself a new job title. I find myself trying to keep everyone on track and trying to keep the older one out of trouble. And I do my own work in the cracks.
Pierce is working from home, helping special needs families as they adapt.
Most of my client families are in more of a survival mode. And I'm just trying to reassure them that getting through a day with your child with special needs really is your success. And if there's learning that goes on, that's great. But if it just looks kind of like a hot mess, that's okay right now.
This is personal work for her. Pierce's oldest child, who is 12, has Down syndrome, and before the pandemic was partially homeschooled. Pierce says it's been hard without her daughter's normal support network, like the local Down syndrome center and sitters and grandparents.
This tends to be a common theme with children with Down syndrome. They are very sociable, and people matter to them in ways that almost don't have words. Like, they really love their people, and they need their people. So she's feeling it hard that she only has the three of us all day long.
Pierce says she needs her people, too. She's missing that outside connection, which became evident during her younger daughter's birthday. Instead of a party, they had a drive-by parade. Neighbors drove by honking and sang happy birthday out their windows.
I mean, I've never had a birthday card tossed at me, but it was tossed at me from the mom's van. My daughter got it. The parade went round and round. My mom was dressed up like a clown. Like, the desire for connection is still so deep, but the ways we can actually connect are very different. I just wanted to hug people. I think my kids did too.
Lorena Pierce says her family, like all special needs families, is meeting the moment because that is just what they do. This is NPR News.
It started as an idea over coffee back in January. Why not make a dashboard mapping all the data of COVID-19 cases?
I'm thinking, yes, why not?
The tiny team at Johns Hopkins University never dreamed it would become so popular.
It just didn't even cross our mind.
Mapping coronavirus around the world this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPA.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and coming up in our newscast, school during the time of COVID-19. Madeline Fox has a look at how schools have been working to make sure their students' needs are taken care of. That's just ahead.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Severe storms and tornadoes are blamed for at least 19 deaths in Mississippi, Arkansas, Georgia, and South Carolina. Tornadoes killed 11 people in Mississippi. In Cleveland, Tennessee, Pastor Dennis Hicks says his church was destroyed.
We're looking forward sometime in the future, maybe to start building it back and doing the repairs necessary.
The National Weather Service has posted tornado watches this morning from northern Florida to southeast Virginia. Dr. Anthony Fauci says it's conceivable parts of the U.S. could begin opening up next month as part of what he calls a rolling reentry, as new coronavirus infections go down and areas emerge from restrictions on non-essential travel. The leading expert on the White House Coronavirus Task Force says that's provided health officials can quickly identify and isolate those likely to become infected. NPR's Tim Mack says President Trump still has critics of how he's responding to the global pandemic.
The president said he would waive license requirements so that doctors could practice in different states. But medical licensing is a state issue, and the president does not have the authority to waive this. He said he would purchase large amounts of oil for the U.S. Strategic Reserve, but he has not yet secured funds from Congress to do so, and still hasn't.
Across the U.S., the virus has killed more than 22,000 people. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. There are 3,341 positive cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin, the State Department of Health Services announced Sunday. According to figures from DHS, 144 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID-19 as of Sunday afternoon. The number of positive test results increased by 128 from Saturday to Sunday. When Governor Tony Evers announced schools would close in mid-March, districts had to scramble to figure out how to keep their students connected and learning. As Madeline Fox reports, that's taken a lot of different forms.
Wisconsin school districts had been using internet learning platforms on school-issued devices along with in-person classes. But it's a big leap from that to full-time online learning. And not all students can learn online outside the classroom. Some don't have devices at home or internet access. Milwaukee Superintendent Keith Posley says the district has been connecting to students in every way it can.
We are sending things out via U.S. mail. Staff has been dropping off items for our young people. We have always had online learning opportunities. We have a number of interventions that our young people are engaged in on a daily basis.
That mix of strategies could be the new normal for a while, as it's looking less likely that students will be back in classrooms this school year. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Brand name businesses that are well known in Wisconsin for stitching together ways to provide protection for first responders and healthcare that have faced a shortage of equipment. Ironwood, Michigan-based Stormy Cromer started in Wisconsin. The company has shifted production from its popular cap to provide thousands of masks and gowns for hospitals and first responders in Wisconsin and Michigan. President Gina Thorson says UW Health in Madison was one of the first hospitals to request, design, and order masks for their staff.
So normally, when we have a new product, it might take several months to go from idea to production. And we had a sample of their mask and had it in production in about 4 days.
Well-known brand Jockey International, based in Kenosha, also recently announced it would donate 250,000 gowns to the Federal Emergency Management Agency for medical facilities and testing sites nationwide. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can always get more news on our website. Go to WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting, and committed to helping nonprofits during this crisis by supporting them remotely with their U.S.-based accounting staff. More at yptc.com. And from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Spain conducts a kind of experiment today. the government starts allowing some non-essential businesses to get back to work. Thousands of workers in sectors like construction and manufacturing are returning with some safety rules, which do not reassure public health experts who think this is coming too soon. Joining us from Spain is Lucia Benavides. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is the government moving now?
So the government is saying that the situation in Spain right now is contained enough to where more people heading to work won't result in a spike of infections. Here's Maria Jose Sierra, who's the spokesperson for the country's Health Emergency Coordination Center.
No tenemos la sensación de que estas medidas tengan que aumentar de una manera importante la transmisión, si no, no las tomaría.
She said she doesn't believe the spread of infections will increase as a result of these rollback measures. But in order to ensure some safety, police officers this morning began handing out 10 million face masks to people heading back to work on board metro and buses, and that includes thousands of people. The Spanish government had to approve this measure. They did so on Friday, but it was met with some opposition. There are some lawmakers that are criticizing the prime minister and his administration for putting economic interests above the health of its citizens.
And what you just mentioned explains why this is so relevant here. We in the United States are facing the same question. How long to stay at home? When can we reopen the economy? Is there some rollout or phased way to do it? But what are health experts saying about what Spain is trying?
Right. A lot of health experts are saying that this is happening too soon in Spain. The Spanish government has been seeking advice over coronavirus measures from a team of health experts. And one member told Spanish media that they were not consulted when the Spanish government made this decision. He expressed concern and said that the sensible thing would have actually been for the shutdown to be extended. Critics in Spain are also pointing out that Spain is a week behind Italy in terms of infections and deaths, and Italy has not lifted its restrictions yet. In fact, they've extended the economic shutdown the shutdown of non-essential businesses to May 3rd.
When you say a week behind Italy, we know how bad Italy has been. That sounds pretty bad. What is the situation in Spain?
It's pretty bad in Spain as well. Spain has the second highest number of cases after the U.S., so it has more cases than Italy at this point. And it has the third number of deaths after the U.S. and Italy. But the rate of new coronavirus infections in Spain is beginning to slow down. On Sunday, there were around 4,100 new cases, which was down 663 from Saturday. And the number of daily fatalities is also decreasing. Today, it was a little bit under 600 deaths in the last 24 hours. And intensive care units are also beginning to see a bit of a reprieve. But healthcare workers are still getting sick, and they worry about getting their families sick as well, because many of them live with parents who are high-risk population. And so we're beginning to see a little bit of the emotional, psychological toll on healthcare workers, some of whom are showing symptoms of depression and even post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and of course, that's a factor here, not just how many people get sick, but can the healthcare system handle them and continue to function? Lucia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lucia Benavides is reporting from quarantine in the suburbs of Barcelona.
Far-right militias and members of something called the Patriot Movement are calling on their followers to openly defy government-enforced COVID-19 restrictions. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports from Idaho.
Ammon Bundy, who led an armed occupation of a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon in 2016 and was later acquitted, hasn't drawn much attention from the news cameras or social media until COVID-19. In defiance of Idaho's stay-at-home order, he's been holding regular in-person meetings in Emmett, a farming town in a river valley near the Oregon border. Bundy wears his cowboy hat and jeans and addresses a couple dozen people while glancing at his notes on his MacBook.
Actually, if it gets bad enough and our rights are infringed upon enough that we physically stand in defense in whatever way we need to.
In Facebook live streams, he often strikes a similar tone as his father, Cliven Bundy, did in the days leading up to an armed standoff near the family's Nevada ranch. Ammon Bundy had pledged to hold non-denominational Easter services yesterday for 1,000 people here. A much smaller crowd turned up at a warehouse he owns in a dusty lot by the Emmett railroad tracks.
You guys can park right here.
One activist played the shofar, an adopted symbol of the Patriot movement. I watched from across the road.
Since I've been here, it looks like maybe a few dozen people have been coming in. American flags on pickups, bumper stickers, saying things like taxation is theft. There's one over there promoting the conspiracy theory website InfoWars. People are hugging. They seem to know each other. I don't see anyone wearing masks.
Even in Idaho, one of the nation's most conservative states, all of this might have been dismissed as bluster were it not for the fact that several elected officials here in the rural Northwest are making similar calls as Bundy.
Quite frankly, I don't know why Idaho is falling in line with some of the most liberal governors across this nation.
One of the most vocal is Republican legislator Heather Scott in the Northern Idaho Panhandle. It's a region long associated with far-right extremism, both imported and homegrown. On her YouTube channel, Scott blames what she says is the lying, Trump-hating media for spreading unfounded fear about the coronavirus. The local sheriff there in Bonner County urged Idaho's Republican governor, Brad Little, to convene the legislature to rescind the order. Now, the governor and his attorney general, who declined interview requests, say their policy is constitutional. Oregon sociologist Randy Blazak studies far-right extremists in the Pacific Northwest.
They're really focusing on how this might be an opportunity to advance their very extremist views.
While there have been hundreds of cases in Blaine County, Idaho, and on Western Indian reservations, Blazak says there haven't been many reported infections in most rural areas.
The people in rural America don't quite see the real body count. And so it's very easy for them to deny the severity of this virus.
Health officials say it's dangerous to cast doubt on stay-at-home orders, one of the only real tools to stop the spread of COVID-19 until a vaccine is available. Dr. Morgan Morton is the chief of staff at Bonner General Hospital in the county where the sheriff says businesses should reopen and people should be free to move about.
I think it's a minority of people, and these people have gotten into office. I'm not exactly sure how, but there are a lot of normal, level-headed people here, and I just hope that they're listening to us and not to them.
Morton says her 25-bed hospital has just 4 ventilators and could easily get overwhelmed if the disease keeps spreading. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
This is NPR News.
And you're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in 9 minutes, some people respond to suffering by turning it into art, and many references to pandemics can be found in music throughout history. NPR Music's Tom Heisinger introduces us to some of the classical music that's been composed in response to frightening infections over the centuries. Stay tuned.
Wisconsin Public Radio is personally important to you. Your gift today ensures that you and everyone in the state has access to this high-quality information and entertainment. WPR is listener-supported, and that's why your gift is so important. Become a member, and you're not only doing something good for yourself, you're doing something good for the whole community. Give now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about 4imprint's dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
Support also comes from Isthmus Partners, an independent asset management firm offering comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for clients nationwide. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
Here's what the weather forecast looks like. A wind advisory for southeastern Wisconsin until tonight with gusts up to 45 miles per hour possible. Winter storm warnings and winter weather advisories in effect for the northeast quadrant of the state. And in the state, in the south, some morning snow, then becoming sunny today. Cloudy with snow in central and northeast Wisconsin. Increasing clouds in the north with rain and snow possible late. Windy around the state and highs in the 30s. For Tuesday, rain and snow showers in the south, partly to mostly sunny in the rest of the state with a few snow showers possible and highs in the 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Wealth Management, where advisors work with their clients to develop flexible investment strategies that can evolve as their needs change. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the Aspen Leadership Group, a national executive search and career management firm serving the not-for-profit sector. Aspen Leadership Group, supporting exceptional careers in philanthropy. And from Americans for the Arts.
It's 8:45 now, Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. As the coronavirus pandemic takes hold in Wisconsin, personal protective equipment is at a premium. That's left some rural ambulance services in the state scrambling to keep up their supplies. Bram Sablesmith reports.
Rob Pohl says the reality of the pandemic hit fast when the first positive case was confirmed in Bayfield County on March 19th.
And I think everybody up here was shocked because they thought we were rural and we moved, and then all of a sudden we had a positive person, and I think there's been two since.
Pulse is paramedic coordinator for Great Divide Ambulance in the town of Cable, population 850. He says his service staffs four ambulances 24 hours a day to cover around 730 square miles. That's four trucks to cover an area three times the size of Chicago. Pulse says he knew his crews were going to have to deal with the virus, but he wasn't expecting it so soon.
I don't want to say we were completely unprepared, but we're learning as we go.
They've had to adjust how they use personal protective equipment. His crews now wear a minimum of a face mask and gloves to every call. If a patient has COVID-19 symptoms, they don N95s, gowns, and face shields. It's a lot more equipment than they're used to using and procuring. Paul says it's been a wake-up call.
You called your regular suppliers, and the phones wouldn't even answer. And some of them, they just kept ringing. So now you call, and you get a message saying, don't even ask us for protective equipment, because we have none.
WPR and Wisconsin Watch spoke with members of six rural EMS services around the state. And while they all say they have enough protective equipment for the moment, sourcing those supplies right now is a challenge. Here's Ryan Olson of Chetek Ambulance Service.
We have tried every vendor that we use. We've searched the internet.
Jim Onstad of Iola Fire and Ambulance.
We reached out to automotive supply stores and purchase some N95s.
Aaron LeClaire of Door County Emergency Service.
We did do that early on. We went around to the local auto stores and bought up half-face respirators.
The state is distributing supplies from the Strategic National Stockpile and other sources. That's helped some rural services. But these same items are in demand all over, and the Department of Health Services has issued guidance on conserving supplies, saying it expects continued shortages. Mark Cohen of the Wisconsin EMS Association says there's another wrinkle to the increased use of protective gear, paying for it.
We're funded by spaghetti suppers and pancake breakfasts.
Unlike fire protection, say, there's no requirement for local governments to provide emergency medical services. Nearly 40% of Wisconsin's emergency medical workforce are volunteers. And in rural areas especially, ambulance services often rely on a patchwork of funding sources. Cohen says protective gear and other precautions makes responding to calls during this pandemic even more costly. So his association sent a letter to Governor Evers on April 3rd asking for a rate increase for emergency medical services. So far, no response.
The dollars that they get don't even come close to covering the cost of pulling the ambulance out of the station.
Back in Bayfield County, Rob Pohl says his service has put a lot of supplies on back order, much more than they need, because he's anticipating many orders won't get filled. Of course, it's also possible they will.
And that's a little dangerous for us financially because, you know, we have a pretty tight budget.
Still, he's hopeful the protective equipment supply chain will catch up eventually. And together, he says, we'll all get through this. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch.
Wisconsin Public Radio thanks the business community for their support.
During this time of social distancing, you can support businesses in your local community by purchasing online gift certificates for future in-person visits. A complete list of WPR business sponsors can be found at wpr.org/current-sponsors.
It's 10 minutes before 9 now, and you're tuned to Morning Edition on WPR. We'll have the latest news for you in 10 minutes from NPR and WPR, and then it's classical music with Stephanie Elkins. A wind advisory for southeastern Wisconsin remains in effect until tonight, with gusts up to 45 miles an hour possible, and winter storm warnings and winter weather advisories still in effect for the northeast quadrant of the state. In the south, morning snow, then becoming sunny. Cloudy with snow in central and northeast Wisconsin today. Increasing clouds in the north with rain and snow possible late. Windy around the state and highs in the 30s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some people respond to suffering by turning it into art. That's true even of the harrowing experience of a pandemic. In the 1400s, a man named John Cook found a text describing the Black Plague in Europe, and he set those words to music. Wow, this is one of many references to pandemics which we can find throughout music history. And our guide to some of that music this morning is NPR Music's Tom Heisinga. Hey there, Tom.
Good morning, Steve.
What were people singing just there?
Well, the piece is called Stella Celi, and the text talks about ulcers of a terrible death, and it also says that the Star of Heaven has rooted out the plague. And of course, the plague that we're talking about, like you said, is the Black Death here, which, according to some reports, wiped out about half of Europe.
So we're not exactly talking about Under the Boardwalk here. This is not a love song.
Not at all.
Although they did seem to give it a happy ending, I suppose, if it goes to the Star of Heaven has rooted out the plague.
And I think what you see, Steve, here in a lot of especially the earlier music is that there are these metaphors between physical health and spiritual health, and that it makes a larger point that people have in mind the idea of frailty of life. And someone like J.S. Bach was no exception.
J.S. Bach wrote pandemic music?
Well, Bach was orphaned twice by the age of 10. He lost half of his 20 children and his first wife. He wrote music that could comfort in times of distress and music that directly, yes, confronted plagues in his cantata number 25. From 1723, that's just a year after the Great Plague in Marseille, France, ended, and that killed over 100,000 people.
Wow.
And here, Bach's text talks about things like the entire world as a hospital and children laid low with sickness. And in this excerpt, the baritone is singing in German, "My plague cannot be healed by any herb or ointment other than the balm of Gilead." And Steve, another important thing about this cantata is indeed its title. It's called There Is Nothing Healthy in My Body, and plenty of references here to sickness and plague.
There was a more modern kind of plague that Americans faced in, that the world faced really in the 1980s, AIDS.
Right, and the World Health Organization says that to date about 35 million have died from AIDS-related illnesses so far. And unfortunately, we can see some parallels with today's coronavirus in that there were many who criticized the Reagan administration at the time for not confronting the virus quickly and honestly enough. And that, along with all of the death, can trigger rage. And musically, that's what we hear in the Symphony No. 1, sometimes referred to as the AIDS Symphony by American composer John Corigliano. Steve, this is just this roiling, heart-on-sleeve elegy to friends that Corleone lost to AIDS. The music is by turns tender and anguished, filled with moments of thunderous fury, and in a way challenging us to respond to it. The first movement of the symphony is called Of Rage and Remembrance, but let's hear a little bit from the second movement called Tarantella, where you can hear a kind of musical hallucination in the fevered mind of an AIDS victim. It's pretty terrifying. Just a little of the chaotic dementia found in John Corleone's Symphony No. 1, written in remembrance of friends he lost to HIV/AIDS. Mm.
Okay, so having gone from Black Plague music to AIDS music, is there any sign how composers and musicians are beginning to respond to COVID-19?
Well, you know, obviously the crisis has really cruelly cut off the livelihood of countless musicians and composers, and even, very tragically, taking the lives of some. We've seen performances online from home, donations being taken. And then there's the New York-based composer Lisa Bielava, who is, as we speak, writing a choral piece, and she calls it Broadcast from Home.
Oh, I can relate to that one. Go on, please.
Well, right. I'm at home myself right now, too. She's really telling the story of the coronavirus by collecting testimonials via social media from people who are in self-isolation and quarantined, and then she's setting those texts to music. And she shared some of that with me that she's working on. Let's take a listen to it. Steve, this excerpt from Lisa Bielava's new piece is called That Other You Still Exists, and it's a part of a much larger work that she just started writing in response to the virus. And here, about 25 different musicians from all over the country recorded their own parts at home and sent them in to the composer. And, you know, at this point, Lisa Bielava doesn't know whether the premiere of her piece will happen virtually online or in public. You know, it all depends on how soon the virus subsides.
Tom, I'm delighted, if that's the word, given the grimness of the subject, delighted by the parallel between the Black Plague music you sent us and what we just heard, in that in each case, a musician took someone else's text, someone else's words, trying to make sense of this very human condition and made it beautiful through music.
And I think what you find is that the composers, while in distress or at least depicting distress, are really trying to tell the stories of regular people. And in times of distress, making important art that hopefully will reach other people will have, hopefully, I think, some kind of soothing balm, some kind of cathartic healing. That's what you can hear, I think, in a lot of these pieces, whether they are directly referencing plagues or the rage and despair of a more modern pandemic.
Tom, be safe.
Thank you. You too, Steve.
That's NPR Music's Tom Heisinger. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Melissa Ingalls, and you can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. Join us this afternoon for BBC NewsHour beginning at 3, followed by All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9. The latest news from NPR and WPR is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from University of Wisconsin Extended Campus, now offering online degrees and courses in health and wellness, science, IT, and more. Complete list at uwex.wisconsin.edu.
Put WPR in your pocket with the WPR app for Android or Apple phones. Get the latest news, stream WPR live, and hear programs when you want them. Download it at the Google Play Store or on the iTunes App Store. WPR is everywhere.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.